Welcome to Culturetopia, NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and culture stories. I'm Sammy Yenigan. This week on Culturetopia, the space shuttle is up for the last time, so if commercial ventures pick up where the space shuttle program leaves off, what will outer space look like? NPR movie critic Bob Mondello says they might take a lesson from Hollywood, which has already boldly gone where no company has gone before. Also, as Boys in the Hood celebrates its 20th anniversary this year, director John Singleton and star Cuba Gooding Jr. look back on the experience of shooting the film that introduced life in South Central Los Angeles. And Ledisi has just released her fifth album as an R&B solo artist. But first...
During the early days of the space race, only governments had deep enough pockets to send humans into orbit. Now commercial ventures are poised to pick up where the shuttle program leaves off. And what will that do to our image of space? Our film critic Bob Mondello knows, because Hollywood has already boldly gone where no company has gone before.
When I was a kid, years before the first space shuttle went into orbit, I knew what outer space was going to be like. I'd seen it at the movies. It was just like Earth, only weightless. In 2001, A Space Odyssey, to get to a space station, characters flew Pan Am. If you're under 30, ask your parents. And once they'd arrived there, apart from curved walls and floors, everything was familiar. You could check into a Hilton, chow down at Howard Johnson's, even check up on the youngsters back home by calling them from a Bell Telephone picture phone booth.
Hello! How are you, Squirt? What are you doing?
Phone booths in the sky seemed less likely by the time NASA had flown the first real shuttle mission in 1981. By then, Silent Running had shown us a future in which corporate spaceships were essentially lifeboats from a planet so wrecked the Earth's few remaining plants had to be shepherded to safety in outer space. American Airlines space freighters took them there in geodesic domes in hopes that they would someday be able to return.
Until that day... May God bless these gods.
Great plan, except that after a while, the airline wanted its freighters back.
We have just received orders to abandon and nuclear destruct all the forests and return our ships to commercial service.
A company putting profit first? How could that be? Actually, greedy space corporations became a Hollywood staple. In the Alien movies, the Weyland-Yutani Corporation really wants one of those diabolical aliens and doesn't want to hear about consequences.
We sat down there on company orders to get this thing, which destroyed my crew and your expensive ship.
Thank you, Officer Ripley. That will be all.
Please, you're not listening to me.
In space, no one can hear you sacrificing humanity for profit. About that same moment, and remember this is still before NASA had put a shuttle into orbit, James Bond was tracking down a hijacked space shuttle and discovering that the guy who'd had it hijacked was the industrialist who'd made it, the evil head of the Drax Corporation.
That's where the Moonraker shuttle is made?
That's right.
I'd heard that Hugo Drax is obsessed with the conquest of space. Now I can believe it.
As a rule, if you like the notion of privatizing outer space, you probably want to steer clear of the multiplex, where starships run by federations and republics tend to be good. Corporate starships, not so much. The by and large megacorp in Wall-E, for instance, evacuating Earth because it had turned the planet into a trash heap.
Too much garbage in your face? There's plenty of space out in space. B&L Starliners leaving each day. We'll clean up the mess while you're away.
Then there was Lunar Industries in the film Moon, economizing while reaping huge profits.
Gertie, have you heard anything new about anyone fixing Lunar Sat?
No, Sam. What I understand is it's fairly low on the company's priority list right now.
And, of course, the RDA Mining Corporation in Avatar, trying to get its hands on a precious resource by military means.
Back on Earth, these guys were army dogs, marines, fighting for freedom. But out here, they just hired guns. Taking the money, working for the company.
There's more, but who needs to zoom into outer space to know the profit motive can lead to greed? It was, after all, the not-for-profit status of NASA's shuttle that's kept it above the fray since its maiden voyage. And in retirement, well, Hollywood's not even giving it a chance to cool its jets. In the film Another Earth, opening in just 2 weeks, a fictional shuttle will be owned not by NASA, but by a space tourism company. Seems pretty benign. Guess we'll see. I'm Bob Mondello.
Dolly Parton released her first solo album in 1967. Since then, she's become a multimedia star in movies and on television. But rock critic Ken Tucker says Parton's new album, Better Day, returns the focus to Parton's singing and her songwriting, which Ken says has frequently been underestimated.
Now, we don't know what heaven looks like, but we've seen enough hell right here and right now. But when the road is the roughest and the problems are the toughest, or when the times are the hardest, or that old sky turns the darkest, you gotta keep the faith, 'cause I believe there's a better day. And those old blues, why, they're gonna just roll right on away. I know they are. Listen to me. All this blue ain't sky and sea. Some of that blue's bound to get on me. But the blues don't come to stay. They'll move away.
Dolly Parton has spent the past few years reconnecting with country music's past, putting out albums that illustrate her love for bluegrass, 1960s-style country-politan ballads, and high lonesome harmony. She had all but conceded the commercial mainstream to a younger generation. But with Better Day, she's trying out a different strategy, placing herself very much in the here and now, even talking about the bad economy and the country's restlessness, but framing the music with a positive, upbeat attitude. The song that serves as the manifesto for this is its lead-off track, In the Meantime.
You know, people been talking about the end of time ever since time began. We've been living in the last days ever since the first day, ever since the dawn of man. Well, nobody knows when the end is coming, but some people tell you they do. Well, it might be today, it might be tomorrow, or in a million years or two. In the meantime, in between time, let us make time to make it right. And let us not fear what is not clear. Faith should be your guide. Just follow.
The greatest days we've ever known are the days we're living in, sings Parton on that song, so drop this doomsday attitude, these are wonderful times we're living in. Optimism in the service of heightened realism suits Parton. Her voice has always curled up into a giggle of glee, a bubble of bumptiousness. Her high pitch has frequently been a place to find jaunty novelty songs that match her cartoonish image. But underneath all the glitter and tight dresses, there's always been a skilled songwriter, a technically adept craftsperson who knows how to weave a metaphor throughout the entire fabric of a song. She does this most intriguingly on The Sacrifice, a song about how hard she's worked, rhyming rhinestones with grindstones without a trace of self-pity.
Well, I've sacrificed time with family and friends, gave up vacations for work without end, 24/7, 365, I was willing to make the sacrifice. But empty or full, I've carried my bill. You don't drink the water if you don't dig the well. Through blood, sweat, and tears, I have built a good life. But it didn't come without sacrifice. And I was gonna be rich no matter how much it cost. And I was gonna
One of the most lovely songs on Better Day is a deceptively simple love song called Somebody's Missing You. With harmonies by her friends Emmylou Harris and Alison Krauss, Somebody's Missing You is the lullaby to an absent lover, assuring him that the singer is thinking only of him. Parton sings the verses as almost whispered secrets.
Somebody's missing you, longs to be kissing you. You'd better listen, you mean all the world to me. You're on somebody's mind, just almost all the time. Bet you already knew somebody's missing you. The days go slow.
Better Day is the album that takes Dolly Parton's sunny smile and makes sure you understand that it's not a Cheshire Cat grin. There's a sincerity and earnest quality to this music that enables it to stand apart from so much of the trumped-up emotionalism and cheesy irony of the pop music world all around it. It may be that, in the words of a song title here, country is as country does, but Parton doesn't just follow country fashion. She makes her own garments and wears them well.
In the early 1990s, South Central Los Angeles had become synonymous with gang violence, drive-by shootings, and crack cocaine. In March 1991, the videotape beating of Rodney King showed a city whose police force seemed out of control. In this environment, 20 years ago this month, the movie Boys in the Hood exploded off the screen. It was the work of a young director just out of film school.
It's hard to be a saint in South Central L.A.
Morning Edition commentator John Ridley has this look back.
In 1990, Stephanie Allaine was one of the few female and very few executives of color at a major Hollywood studio, Columbia Pictures. In May of that year, Stephanie was busy looking for someone to fill her old job of reading scripts for the studio.
And I heard about a kid who was still in school who was interested in the job. So I called him up. Little John shows up in my office, and he starts telling me about the script that he wrote. And he's telling me how he's going to direct it and this and that, and he's not in school, but he has an agent. And I'm thinking, okay, this kid's not really a reader. He's a writer. Let me read the script.
The kid was 22-year-old John Singleton. John had a script called Boys in the Hood that told the story of Trey, Ricky, and Doughboy. Three friends growing up with dreams of one day moving beyond their violent circumstances in South Central.
Y'all want to see a dead body?
Yeah.
Trey's daddy blasted at somebody last night.
Really? What kind of gun your daddy got?
The script focused on the relationship of Trey Stiles and his father, Furious, a single parent trying to instill values in his troubled son, contrary to the pressures and temptations of his environment.
You know, Trey, you may think I'm being hard on you right now, but I'm not. What I'm doing is I'm trying to teach you how to be responsible. It's like your little friends across the street, they don't have anybody to show them how to do that. They don't. You're going to see how they end up, too.
It's the story that a lot of those cats used to make in the 80s in the suburbs, but made in the hood.
The film's writer and director, John Singleton.
I loved those pictures at that time, but I also felt alienated because none of those people look like me. So me and my friends would catch the bus up to Hollywood, and we go see the movies, and then we spend the whole time going down Vermont talking about what movies we would make. It would always be something like what I did with Boys in the Hood.
The script was written with a power and immediacy that absolutely floored Stephanie Allaine.
It was one of those moments where I closed my door, I sat, and I read it in one sitting, and I was devastated. And I closed it, and I thought, okay, this is what I'm here to do.
You bad. You got to shoot somebody now. Look, I'm sorry about your friend. My heart goes out to his mother and his family, but that's their problem, Trey. You my son. You my problem.
A lot of people don't really understand what it is to be young, black, and male and grow up in L.A. It's like you're taught to have the potential to explode. You know, it's like if a person looks at you wrong or a certain slight could turn into like, you know, boom.
It's that perspective that John wanted to put on screen. Never mind he'd never done a feature film before. John was determined to direct the script himself. Stephanie Elaine recalls at one point the studio tried to bribe John into letting someone else direct the movie.
He was offered like $100,000 just to walk away. You know, what would you say if we gave you $100,000? And John was so cool. I was so proud of him. He was like, I'd say this conversation's over.
John began casting the film focusing on the lead role, Trey Stiles. Eventually, the part went to a very pre-Oscar-winning Cuba Gooding Jr., still just a kid himself, on the hustle for his next gig.
You got to remember, this was early in my career. I didn't know what stage direction was. I didn't know what EXT, INT, period. I didn't know that meant exterior, interior. I didn't know we were outdoors or indoors. I just knew my lines. I knew Trey's lines. I knew his father, furious, is mad at him. And I knew that emotion. That's how I came to this story.
Singleton went on to fill out the cast with established veteran Lawrence Fishburne, as well as what would become a who's who of actors. Angela Bassett, Regina King, Morris Chestnut, Nia Long, and in his first role as an actor, rapper Ice Cube. Cuba Gooding Jr. remembers the relative inexperience of the cast didn't keep them from sensing that something special was happening.
None of us knew what we were involved with. We just knew that we had nothing to lose to put our whole body, heart, and soul into these roles. And that's exactly what we were looking to do.
Trey, what happened? Trey, what happened? Talk to me. What happened? What happened to Ricky?
Trey.
Talk to him. Something just happened to Rick. I don't know. It just got shot. Something happened to Rick.
Wait, now.
In watching the film, it's truly amazing that the 22-year-old Singleton was able to coax such mature performances from his cast. It helped that John was able to take directing lessons from Francis Ford Coppola by way of Lawrence Fishburne, who'd previously worked with Coppola on Apocalypse Now.
This before we even started, I said, I need to know everything. Tell me everything you did that Francis taught you as an actor. And we sat in my little apartment and everything. He'd say they would read the script and they would do improvisations that had to do with the characters and nothing to do with the script, to flesh out the characters. He says, and then we'd eat a lot of pasta and drink some wine and stuff, right?
Once completed, the film was instantly recognized as being extraordinary. It became an official selection in the 1991 Cannes Film Festival, and on July 12th, Boys in the Hood opened nationally to both critical and financial success. It took in nearly $60 million at the box office, and Boys earned Singleton an Academy Award nomination for Best Original Screenplay and Best Director. He was both the youngest and the first Black American to be nominated in the director category. In the two decades since, John Singleton has gone on to write, direct, and produce films that have earned nearly $500 million at the box office, including Shaft and Too Fast, Too Furious. But Boys in the Hood remains his signature piece. Stephanie Elaine.
After 20 years and having seen the movie so many times, I still cry. It's still very powerful.
In 1991, John Singleton just wanted to make a movie with characters that look like him. 20 years later, it's clear that he's left us with a powerful documentation of the pains and hopes and dreams of an entire city. Ooh, child, things are gonna be
easier. The voice you're about to hear belongs to an R&B singer named Ledisi. She's our music feature today.
One call, two calls, three calls. Is that what I do to you? Outside my door, scared to be alone. I know you're addicted to.
This track is called Hate Me, and it's off Ledisi's new record, Pieces of Me. Now, not too long ago, before she became known as an R&B singer, you'd have probably heard Ledisi singing parts written by Puccini or Wagner. She spent years honing her operatic voice, first as a child prodigy and later at UC Berkeley. But those days are long gone. Ledisi is becoming a star in the world of R&B, and her new record, her fifth studio album, is quite possibly her most personal. Ledisi joins me from our studios at NPR West. Great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
So the song that we're hearing, it's called Hate Me, which I imagine has a story behind it. I wonder if, or whether you can tell me what this whole record, Pieces of Me, is actually about.
Well, Pieces of Me is celebrating being a full woman. I'm becoming a great woman that I adore. It takes a while to really love yourself, and so I'm celebrating all those different parts. And I can be very sensual, spiritual, aggressive, which is like the song Hate Me, and very just exuberant, and I wanted to express those sides.
You have been in this business, in the recording business, the entertainment business, for a long time. You really started at the age of 8. You've had several Grammy nominations, and yet I read that you had doubts even about this record, you know, as to whether you could ever even make it.
I'm always doubting because I've been told so much that you're not the right look or you're not the right sound. And, you know, whether I do jazz or R&B, there are always complaints. And I would just listen to the complaints about what I do instead of celebrating what I do and that I'm different and I'm in my own lane and to embrace that.
Tell me about your family, because you grew up in a pretty musical family. Your mom was in an R&B band in Louisiana. You were performing at the age of 8 with a New Orleans Symphony Orchestra.
Yes, my mom saw that I had a talent, so she would put me in programs, and one of the programs was NOCA, and only 4 students per school was able to perform with the New Orleans Symphony. So I was one of the students chosen for that after-school program. That was my first introduction to opera.
And opera, of course, became a really big part of your life. You went on to study at UC Berkeley in the Young Musicians Program. I'm assuming, by the way, that you're a mezzo-soprano, is that?
Yes, I am. How did you know?
Well, you know, lucky guess. I was listening to this record through the prism of knowing that you studied opera, and all of a sudden, it was weird. It just made sense to me. I thought, there's this strange kind of symbiosis between R&B, soul, and opera.
Yeah, I think there's a story. There's always a story in music, and it's expressed through my music. I'm everything I'm made of. So a part of me is made of classical music. I'm grateful for it. I study diction and breathing control and phrasing and why the song means something. And you want to bring that across to your listeners. Gotta serve it to me.
So this track we're hearing is called Coffee, and I should mention it's only marginally about coffee. let us see. How do you like your coffee?
This song, you know, I avoided this song so much. It became a favorite. Rex Rideout, my executive producer, he said, "Led, I have this song for you. I want you to hear. I want you to at least demo it." And I kept going, "I don't want to. It's too sensual. It's too much describing how I like my man. The lyrics were more risque than what you hear now." So I said, "Well, if I can change the lyrics around, I'll demo it." And we ended up using the demo. So what you hear is the first takes of everything. I love it now. It's my Shug Avery side. That's what I call it.
Gotta serve it to me hot. That's what you sing.
Just like I like my coffee.
Got it. I mean, a lot of the tracks on this record, they are about intimacy. I mean, this really is an intimate record.
Yes, I wanted it to be that way. You know, people know what I look like. They're starting to know that. And they're starting to know my name and what I'm able to sing, but they don't know anything intimately about me. And so here it is.
Were you nervous about showing that side of you?
Of course. Mm. I'm always talking about, you know, the grind of making it and spirituality and things like that. So here I am talking about kisses and hugs and things and coffee. So it's very different. But what's doing music without risk? So here I am.
I'm speaking with R&B soul singer Ledisi about her new record. It's called Pieces of Me. Ledisi, you have a pretty awesome, and I should say powerful fan in the First Lady, Michelle Obama.
Yes.
You have actually met her, right?
Yes, I've met her and spoke, and she's invited me twice to the White House. I performed at the Motown Tribute with wonderful other artists like Seal and John Legend and Stevie Wonder. It was amazing. And then I was invited in the same month by the First Lady to come back and do a mentoring program for women. And she spoke about 3 women in her speech, and I was one of them, about their journey
Wow.
of never giving up. And I'm sitting in the chair melting, thinking, okay, just smile because you don't have any makeup and everyone's going to look at you. Don't cry. So it was amazing to have someone that powerful to me, who I look up to me. So it's a mirror. And, you know, after that, I left feeling like I can do anything. So, yeah, that contributed to my confidence that you hear and feel right now. Stuck in the middle, I can see where I've been. My eyes are open and I know where I'm going. So much is in the way. There are people around being negative and they always got something to say. They say you'll never be what you want to be.
I love the energy in this song. It's such a great song. This one is called Shut Up. And one of the things that you've said about this record that I've read is that, you know, you're more confident in your music now and in yourself. And I think I hear it in this song.
Yes, most definitely. Shut Up was just my, you know, someone cut me off on the freeway in L.A. And Mike City, he produced the track with me. And he gave me the track a long time ago and I hadn't recorded to it. And that song just came to mind. And I was thinking of all the people that told me, you'll never get far, you're never going to be anything. And I thought about it. I said, gosh, I wish I could have told them, shut up, because that can defer a dream.
So now that this record is getting a lot of attention, and you're getting a lot more attention than you have in the past, does it feel strange, or do you sort of feel like, you know, I've worked so hard over the last decade, and now I deserve this?
I do feel like I was discussing with my mom about it, and we both started crying. She's like, it's about time, you know, as a mother would say. And me, I'm thinking, wow, now I have even more work to do because the expectations are so high. And they're not saying Ledisi anymore. They're saying Ledisi everywhere I go. So, yeah, it's a bit overwhelming. I'm used to being the nobody. So finally I'm somebody. Well, I always thought I was, but to the rest of the world. And that's a big, big... Gosh, it feels good. It feels good.
That's singer-songwriter Ledisi. Her new album is called Pieces of Me, and she joined me from our studios at NPR West in Southern California. Ledisi, thank you so much, and good luck with
the record. Thank you for having me. Thank you. I got a new
walk and a new point of view. That's all for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I'm Sammy Yenigan. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. Same letter, see, but she ain't walking, she's flying.